Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Thanks for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast with Adrian Goldberg. This week, he sheds a light on the dark web, a hidden corner of the internet where dealers can trade outlaw drugs without fear of detection.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Now, 5 Live Investigates. Sunday nights from 9. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Now, we all know that the internet harbours more than a few dodgy websites. But what if I told you there was a whole other secret online world beyond the reach of conventional search engines that only those in the know can get to, and where drug dealers, arms traders and paedophiles are able to trade freely without fear of detection? Well, we broke this story on Friday and we're talking about the world of the dark web. To highlight the risk it poses, we've even used it to order a Class A hallucinogenic drug that carries a 7-year jail sentence for possession. And our reporter Mike Wendling has been investigating. First off, Mike, why is it called the dark web?
Well, it's called the dark web because the websites on it are invisible to conventional search engines. They require special software, special technical knowledge to access. You're not going to find these sites just by searching on Google.
OK, so what did you buy there?
We ordered DMT, which is a Class A hallucinogenic drug. It's like LSD, only more powerful, therefore more dangerous. Anybody who deals in DMT can be jailed for life. But there were plenty of other options too. We saw various drugs for sale, for instance, cocaine and heroin.
Heavy stuff. I mean, are you sure, Mike, that the drugs you ordered were real, not just talcum powder, for example?
Yeah, we're sure, because we obviously didn't want to hold on to the drugs we ordered. So we took them straight to the experts at Analytical Services International at St. George's University of London. They ran the test for us, and they confirmed that we bought genuine DMT. They've also disposed of it for us.
So how do you get onto the dark web?
To get there, you need to use what's called an anonymizing network. The one we used is called Tor. This is freely available on the web, and it makes the location of your computer and the sites you've visited virtually impossible to trace. It does this by bouncing communications between a network of volunteers around the world. In effect, that scrambles the information about who you are and about where you've been on the web so that nobody can track it.
OK, so now you're on the dark web if you've downloaded Tor or some similar software. So do you just key in drugs to bring up a list of sites selling them?
It's not quite as simple as that, Adrian. Tor is not a search engine, and there's no real equivalent of Google on the dark web. Instead, you have to know the exact address of where you want to go.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they're quite obscure. Just like in the real world, I suppose, a drug user would need to know a dealer or know where to go to find a dealer.
Yeah.
We were tipped off about one website called Silk Road. It's like an online marketplace. We found out the address of the site, and from there on, it was easy as buying a book over the internet. When you access the site, on the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a list of all the different types of drugs and all the other goods that you can buy. You click on the drug you want, and then you can choose who to buy it from.
Yeah, and one user who has frequently used this website, Silk Road, to buy drugs is an American student who spoke to us. Now, we'll call him David because he asked not to be identified, and I asked him what drew him to using the dark web.
I think the same thing that attracts anyone else to using it, and that would be the availability of illegal drugs.
And you have bought illegal drugs through Silk Road?
I have, successfully. You don't have to go in front of a street dealer with the risk of violence. You have the availability of multiple dealers so you can compare products. It acts almost as a legal industry now because you have the competition. It makes it safer in that the risk of violence is effectively zero. People don't know who you are.
I get the sense from chatting with you that you believe that you are acting outside the law, but that you are on the side of good. Just explain the philosophy, if you would, behind what you're doing.
It's definitely very libertarian. Some people may go as far as anarchy, but I think the majority are just very much against the war on drugs. They've seen the damage it causes.
You will be aware that many people have died as a result of using hard drugs. Are you not concerned that many young people might damage their lives, might lose their lives?
But someone who wants to try heroin or another addictive substance is going to find it. So I think the best thing you can do is educate them. A lot of people in the forums will try and tell you, like, this drug is very dangerous, you should be careful with it.
Are you familiar with any British users of Silk Road?
Yes, there are definitely British sellers.
British drug dealers.
Drug dealers.
So he's pretty unapologetic, Mike, that user there. He uses the dark web, access the Silk Road website. What do we know about the dealer who you found?
The sellers on these sites, they live or die by their reputation. So in that sense, it's just like the Criminal Underground's version of eBay. You can leave feedback after every transaction. Our dealer had very good feedback from the other people who'd used him. There were several comments from people on his profile saying how reliable he was. If the dealer was a scammer selling fake drugs, he would quickly be found out. He'd have a zero rating.
So what happened when the drugs actually arrived?
Well, the dealer had obviously been thinking about what might happen if they were intercepted.
Yeah.
He told us what he sent would come in a fake invoice addressed to a made-up person so that if anybody opened the letter, they'd think it was a misunderstanding. He told us he'd done this hundreds of times and that there hadn't been any problems. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So it looks like the people who use these kinds of sites have thought about how they can deny any knowledge of what they're up to, which would make it, no doubt, very difficult to prosecute somebody who was caught.
Indeed. I mean, surely if the authorities were suspicious, though, I mean, they could trace the payment details through your credit card or your debit card.
Well, actually, no, because we couldn't pay by credit card or any other conventional means. You have to pay on this website and on the dark web in general with something called bitcoins. I actually got into this story after first hearing about Bitcoin. It's a virtual currency. It was invented just 3 years ago, but it's becoming increasingly popular. Now, bitcoins can be exchanged for most major currencies, and they're used perfectly innocently by online gamers, also by a growing number of legitimate businesses, online and offline. But just like cash, bitcoins can also be used for illegal transactions, for instance, to buy drugs like we did.
Okay, so you buy your bitcoins with real money, but once you start trading with them on the dark web, because the dark web is anonymous, basically nobody knows what you've spent them on. It could be for something legitimate like gaming. It could be something illegal like drugs.
Yeah, that's right, and that makes it attractive to criminals. Mm. Bitcoin transactions aren't linked to names, so they add an extra layer of secrecy to dealings on the dark web.
Yeah.
So whereas your bank statement might record that you've bought bitcoins, there's no indication what you spent them on. On the other end of the deal, the dealer can convert the bitcoins back into cash and just say he won them gaming online or selling legitimate products. The point is, nobody can prove any difference.
And Mike, there isn't any question, is that this website, Silk Road, knows what's going on. I mean, they must be aware, surely.
No, whoever they are, the people running Silk Road are totally open about the fact that illegal drugs are sold on their site.
Wow. Let's find a bit more about this online currency then. Bitcoins from Amir Tarker. He's the co-founder of the Bitcoin Consultancy, which develops Bitcoin-related services. Amir, good evening to you.
Yeah, good evening. So, good to be on Five Live.
Yeah, welcome. Why are you promoting a currency, though, that is so easily exploited by those who want to buy and sell drugs, as we have proved?
Well, here's the thing. It's the dual-use dilemma. You know, Bitcoin has a massive potential for positive social good. You know, science and technology are neutral. So something like the atom bomb, it can take us to new worlds or wipe entire countries off the earth. You know, science and technology is neither hostile nor benign.
Well, Amir, we know the bad that bitcoins can do. They allow people to buy illegal drugs and possibly weapons on the internet. What is the good that you think they can do?
Well, Bitcoin is the first time that we have democratic money, a digital democratic money. And the system is completely decentralized. There is nobody that controls the functioning of how Bitcoin works. And out of this fact that it's a decentralized network, you get all of these amazing properties, things like it's international, you know, that it's always running, that there's very, very low fees, a very strong privacy model, a transparent system. You know, there's a lot of anger today towards the banks or mismanagement of funds. something like that can never happen with Bitcoin. It's an incorruptible system.
But it may be incorruptible as a system, but it allows for corrupt people to operate it, doesn't it? And the fact the fact that it allows people to trade anonymously and trade in drugs and other illegal items is precisely the advantage it has for criminals over debit cards or credit card transactions.
The thing is, sites like the Silk Road are a very small percentage of the Bitcoin network. And, you know, you can say something like GPS, you know. GPS receivers are military technology. They were developed for the military. And terrorists could use GPS receivers to guide them to their targets. And the only way to stop them is to take them from everyone else. Imagine if no one could use GPS receivers. What would that do to the economy?
Amir, it's Mike Wendling in the studio here. In the course of our investigation, we found it actually a bit difficult to get Bitcoins. It's not really mainstream yet, is it? And it kind of makes it a bit more difficult to get them. That means that, you know, you have to be very determined to get them.
Actually, it's not so difficult. You know, there are several exchange sites. Like, I'm actually running one in the UK called Intersango, and all you do is you make a deposit, you buy Bitcoins, and you cash them out. It's really not that hard. And the fact is that the Bitcoin system is really undeveloped right now. So if you remember the early web, you know, there were like a few websites. It wasn't really used a lot. And if a business had a website, it was only because, you know, they were trying to be hip or trendy. But nowadays, now we see today where everybody has websites. Bitcoin is much the same thing. It's like the early internet.
But Amir, we've established how it can be used for illegal means. I'm still struggling to understand the positive aspects to it. I mean, you talk about it being easily interchangeable. Well, that is true of dollars, of pound sterling, of euros. You talk of it being accessible 24/7. The same is true of dollars, of sterling, of euros. The only difference is that Bitcoin allows people to trade anonymously on the internet and therefore hide their criminal dealings.
No, that's not really true. Dollars and pounds are not easy to use on the internet. You know, now we see this question about how can we have micropayments on the internet. It's been a long-standing question. And you see these systems like Flutter and PayPal, which is trying to talk about, like, how can we fund artists and digital culture using online payment schemes. But the thing is, these systems don't really work that well. You know, if you go on YouTube, you sometimes see people who have, like, a YouTube video of, like, 100 million views. Imagine if that artist, right, could get 1 cent for every view. He now has $1 million. This is the kind of thing that Bitcoin is made for. It's really something that has a massive potential.
But it doesn't do that at the moment, does it? But we do know that it allows criminals to sell drugs.
Well, actually, it does, because there's this artist, and I was listening to him for many, many months, right? And I wanted to give him some money as a show of appreciation for his work. And I'd go and, you know, try and give him some PayPal, I'd fill out my name, my address, my date of birth, you know, my telephone number, you know, a sample of blood. And then I'd try and do it, and it would just not work for some reason. And eventually it just got so annoying that I just said to him, hey, look, do you want to take some Bitcoins? And he said, okay, let me just check it out. And then he came back to me and said, yeah, sure, and gave me his address. And just with a single click, I sent from the UK to the US this artist some Bitcoins. And he put it up on his website, and I came and checked a few months ago, and he had dozens of payments from other people.
OK, Amir Tarka, fascinating insight into the world of Bitcoins. And as always, we want your reaction to what you're hearing. Have you bought goods from Silk Road? Have you used the dark web or indeed Bitcoins for anything else? Or do you think more should be done to shut down illegal activity on the web? You can text us on 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, or on Twitter, we're at BBC 5 Live.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
On 5 Live Investigates tonight, the secret online world where criminals can buy and sell drugs, guns and fake driving licences without fear of being caught. It's known as the dark web, and you need special software to get into it. We're getting your reaction to this, and Mike Wendling's been sifting your responses, Mike.
Yes, we've had text, emails. Brian says, people use pounds to buy and sell drugs. Are you proposing banning the pound? we had an email in referring to David, our American user of Silk Road and the dark web, saying, I wonder how David would feel if somebody purchased a gun off the dark web and shot him. What would he think of freedom of choice for the person who did that, were he able to do it? Another one, I use the site in question all the time, from an anonymous writer. The law doesn't reflect people's opinions. If you want something enough, you'll source it. Removing the website will only result in a dozen clones popping up.
Okay, we'll keep your comments coming. You can text 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, or on Twitter, we're at BBC 5 Live. Now, Mike, we've been hearing about how easy it was for you to find and buy illegal Class A drugs on the dark web, but that's not all you can find there.
That's right. You'll remember we paid for the drugs with this virtual currency, bitcoins. Well, we had a few left over after buying the drugs, so we had a look at some of the books and other things that you could download or buy from the site. There was one book which gave instructions about how to crack even the most secure IT systems, another about manipulating cash machine menus to get extra money out without it showing on your account. We saw another one about barcode manipulation, in other words, looking for products in shops and being able to get them at lower prices. It explains how scammers are successfully ripping off stores of huge amounts of money.
So basically, it sounds like it's encouraging crime in the real world as well as online.
Yeah, and that was made even more clear when we saw the number of forged documents for sale. There's driving licenses, student IDs, even doctor's notes.
So I guess the police must be really concerned now about the emergence of this virtual world, which, from what we've discovered tonight, seems to be beyond their reach.
Yes, and we get the impression this isn't just small-scale scammers. We're talking about potentially violent criminals using the dark web. We came across all manner of dangerous weapons, switchblades, bullets, even guns were being sold on there. For instance, at the moment, there's a 9mm pistol for a silencer. It's on sale for just over 237 bitcoins. That's around £900.
And you could have bought that, Mike, in exactly the same way as you bought the illegal Class A drugs using bitcoins. And nobody, as far as we can tell, would have been able to find out about that transaction.
That's right. Totally anonymous. Here.
That's really scary stuff. Now, we have proved, as I say, that it is possible to buy illegal items on the dark web without being caught. And the method we used could be used for absolutely anything. I want to get a word now with Joseph Menn. Joseph, twice nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, author of Fatal System Error, The Hunt for the New Crime Lords Who Are Bringing Down the Internet. And John, we've been talking about this one small corner of the dark web. How dangerous do you think, for example, Silk Road is?
Well, Silk Road sort of brings what's been going on underground, criminal to criminal, to a potentially broader marketplace. Now, it's still not absolutely everybody. Certainly not everybody feels comfortable with bitcoins, this electronic only currency, which can be pretty unpredictable. You wouldn't want to put your life savings into it. But it does bring the world of criminal to criminal, sophisticated underground web transactions to a potentially broader audience.
And Joseph, you mentioned the fact that criminals have used it in the past. Has this been used previously before the emergence of bitcoins, sort of for criminals to talk and use the internet undetected between themselves?
You're speaking about Tor and the encryption.
Yeah, absolutely. The dark web in general. Yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, one of the few weak points of the underground criminal economy is the fact that you have to specialize and you have to have one specialist deal with other specialists. So it's very unlikely that you have a botnet, for example, that can be used. All these compromised computers that can be used for attacks on rivals or something like or on legitimate companies. It's very unusual that you'd have that, and you'd also have serious virus writing capability to infiltrate targeted computers and everything else. So you need to deal with others, and you do that on these underground forums, which are password protected. Somebody has to vouch for you. Typically you're communicating over instant messages that are encrypted or via Tor. There are many ways to do that. But again, this is something that's been going on for a long time without without sort of this interface to the wider public.
Yeah, so do we know how much crime is being committed by behind these shields of anonymity or by the very nature of it? Can we simply not know?
Well, no, we there's no way to get an accurate fix on it. The estimates of all cybercrime, I think the credible estimates range from something like 100 billion dollars a year to up to $1 trillion trillion dollars a year. That's something that's coming out of the mouth of the U.S. president. He cited industry estimates there, but nobody knows. I mean, these people obviously don't file tax returns.
Indeed. But you believe that the emergence of bitcoins now as a kind of readily convertible currency and the development of sites like Silk Road kind of takes online crime to a new level?
It has the potential to. I wouldn't say that bitcoins are readily convertible. It takes some effort, and the market for bitcoins has pretty much crashed. So, I mean, I think you could have made a better case that bitcoins are a critical part of this dark web a year or so ago. It's very unclear right now. But there are other ways to do it. I mean, certainly the bad guys have accepted, the equivalent of PayPal. Web money is one. It's a Russian-based electronic transfer service. There are ways to do it. You can launder your money through a variety of means and pay off bad guys and not get caught, generally speaking.
And are those anonymous ways of shuttling money around and maybe sort of buying the things that we found, drugs and guns as well?
Well, semi-anonymous. Bitcoins itself are not purely anonymous. There's still going to be something on your computer that's associated with you, and if the police get a warrant, they can search your computer and they can reconstruct it. So it is absolutely not foolproof, and people should not think that they're going to get away with something just because they're using bitcoins. But it does advance the state of the art some, and it's going to continue going that way. I mean, you don't have to be a hacker anymore to engage in cybercrime. You can be a pretty much a common citizen.
Joseph, stay there if you would. I want to bring in John Carr. John is a leading expert on young people's use of the internet and an advisor to the UN on the subject. Good evening, John.
Hi there.
We've been talking about goods, drugs, guns and so on, but we've also heard that child porn is being traded online. Do you have any sense of how much the dark web is being used by paedophiles?
Just like Joseph was saying now, nobody can put any definite numbers on it, because these guys don't fill in annual returns helpfully telling us how much bad stuff they're doing. But we've had odd glimpses. A few years ago, there was a big website taken down in Texas that was selling child pornography, and there were 7,200 names on that server of guys from the UK who'd been using their regular credit cards to buy these illegal images. So nearly half of them were arrested, and a good number went to jail. That single operation produced a huge sort of crisis, really, within the police systems for analyzing computers and so on. The forensic labs were completely overbooked. It took 2 years in some police forces to get computers looked at. And more recently, there have been some estimates to suggest that on some of these Tor clients and some of these similar types of peer-to-peer type networks, the volumes of images, and the numbers of people, rather, involved could be many, many times greater than that operation that produced such strains on the legal system all those years ago.
And John, you talked about tracing people there through their credit card details, but of course, a similar paedophile picturing these days, if they were using bitcoins or another anonymous internet currency, the police wouldn't know where to start, would they?
Absolutely. I think people completely overestimate the capacity of some of our law enforcement agencies to keep up with this, because they're not getting the money, the right level investment to help them to do it. And what this means is that we have to look more and more to the industry itself to help the cops, and by that we're talking really about us, society. To try and at least have a fighting chance of winning this battle. But by the way, I mean, there are other ways of being anonymous on the internet and buying stuff which are a great deal simpler than bitcoins. You can walk into almost any garage in Britain these days and buy a credit card for cash over the counter and give a completely fictitious name when you register it. Nobody cares to check, nobody does check, and use that as a means of paying for illegal software, illegal music, whatever. So there are lots and lots of ways of having a stab at being anonymous. I mean, obviously, if the cops find out your name and address, they can come and get your computer, but the volume of this stuff is so large that the chances of that happening might be quite low.
John Carr, thank you. Joseph Mend, one final question for you. I mean, wouldn't it be simpler if we shut down sites like Tor that allow people to be anonymous?
I think that's impossible, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Tor has gotten a majority of its funding in past years from the U.S. government. It helps folks in places like Egypt and Tunisia communicate with each other and with the outside world with little or less fear of apprehension from some fairly unpleasant authorities. It's one of the good things about the Internet is that you can communicate in that kind of a scenario and not get caught. And, you know, there's some people will use that for good and some people will use that for ill. So even if it were possible to shut it down, there would be others that would spring up and take its place. And I would say it's not at all clear that that's bad.
Joseph Mend, thank you. Thanks also to John Carr. And as always, we want your reaction to what you've been hearing tonight. Should we be free to buy whatever we want on the internet? Have you ever used the dark web yourself? Or does this prove we need more vigorous policing of the online world? You can text 85058. You can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk or on Twitter, we're at Adrian Goldberg. Coming up, we'll hear from a software designer who helps people access the dark web. He'll tell us why, despite all we've heard about the sale of contraband goods, he believes it's a force for good.
On DAB Digital Radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
On 5 Live Investigates tonight, we're taking your texts, your emails and tweets on tonight's story about the dark web, a hidden part of the internet where drugs, guns and other illegal material can be bought and sold anonymously. Mike Wendling's been going through your reactions. What have we got, Mike?
Well, picking up on what our last guest mentioned about activists in the Middle East, we had an email in saying, I'm glad that the dark web exists to protect political campaigners. We've also had some texts in. There's nothing that can be used for good which cannot also be used for evil. Bitcoins are no different. Tom says, I've used Bitcoin since it started. It's rapidly growing. A lot of experts will predict it will be the future of internet transactions. And I also have a text here from Andy who says, I've been using the dark web for a while. It's no different to walking around Camden in the things you can buy. It just makes it easier and safer. Long live the dark web.
Very interesting. I've got a question, Mike. If you could see all this stuff available on the dark web, why couldn't you get me something decent for my throat? Now, as we've been saying, we've had dozens of emails and texts and tweets in response to this story. One of the reactions was from Alistair Patterson, who is the chief executive of a company called Digital Shadows, which specialises in online security, and he joins me now. Hi, Alistair.
Good evening.
So just tell us what Digital Shadows does then.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the discussion so far has been around weapons and drugs on the dark web. But actually, it's also a playground for the hackers. So these are the hackers who would break into organizations and steal their information. And actually, they're able to use the dark web to plan and coordinate those attacks and actually use it as a place to sell the information that they steal.
So just explain that then, Alistair. How do they do that?
As with everyone else who uses the dark web, they're protected by a degree of anonymity.
Yeah.
So they're able to discuss quite freely what they're planning to do, who they're planning to attack and how they would do it. And that enables them to build support and gain a larger group of people to be involved in that attack.
They can recruit people to hack for them. Maybe if they've got a grudge against a company or against an organisation, or perhaps if they want to access confidential material.
Exactly that. There's actually hackers for hire. So it's possible to pay someone to take down a website or to crack a password for you online.
Alistair, we know that a lot of companies hire hackers or specialists or experts. I take it that a lot of I suppose the other side are on the dark web as well, spying on or fighting against these dark hackers.
Yeah, indeed, it is possible to find all sorts of stuff on there, and I think it's important to put things in perspective, though. So although there's been this huge growth in cybercrime, as we heard earlier on the program, I think 2011 was called the year of the data leak or similar. It's got to be put in perspective with the wider internet. So the dark web is just one of the risks organisations face, and in fact their digital shadow, so all of the information they accidentally expose online, extends far beyond just the dark web.
Now, you deal with online security, so if you're looking around the dark web, what kind of things are you actually looking out for?
So we found incidences where our clients are actually being targeted specifically. So we'll find a group discussing how they're going to break into an organisation. I'll give you an example from last year. We were helping a mining company who thought they were about to be attacked. We were able to identify how that attack would take place and when it would take place, and so they were able to help protect themselves. And similarly, we've been working from the start of our business with a human rights organisation who's been under a lot of pressure from different nations where their opinions might be unpopular and their people are at risk. So we've been working to help them as well.
Really? So some of the hackers attacking this human rights organisation might even be nation states or people acting on behalf of nation states?
Indeed, yeah. I don't know if you saw on the news I think it was 2 weeks ago now, there was an attack on the Israeli Stock Exchange and their financial institutions. Yeah. And that was then backed by Hamas as a good thing to do. And so certainly, yeah, that was for political, ideological reasons. And those are the same sort of ideological reasons that our the human rights organisation we help has to deal with.
And do you actually have to go undercover online if you're accessing the dark web to find out who these people are and what they intend to do?
So we don't try and actually identify these people. That's for the law enforcement community. We just try and help the organisations that we work with and stop them getting attacked. So we're looking out for any mention of them and their assets in the dark web, essentially.
Yeah.
It seems like, a day doesn't go by without something in the news about this. Obviously, the big story this week was the conversation between the FBI and Scotland Yard.
Yeah.
Do you think this is going to continue where, people are going to need services like yours more and more hackers get on the web as well?
I think so. I mean, if the last year's been anything to go by, then that's certainly the way things are going. I think organisations are becoming more and more aware of their exposure online as they become more dependent on the internet, particularly as they engage with the social web. They're presenting an even bigger sort of digital footprint, and within that there are risks in their digital shadow, so all of the things that they're unaware they're exposing. So it's not just the dark web. So if you were to look at Google and you type in something simple like confidential, not for distribution in quotes, file type PDF, you'd end up with over 24,000 results. And these are all documents that are supposedly marked confidential and not for distribution.
Now, Alistair, over and above the work that you do in online security, is just as you've delved around the dark web, what kind of things have you seen that have disturbed you?
I think there's a whole lot of very disturbing content on there. We've heard about the drugs and the weapons and obviously the sort of very harrowing images that are accessible, and we try not to focus on any of that. I think, there's a lot of good, as if, I don't think it's really come out much on the show tonight yet, about the way it's been able to help dissidents in regimes where they need to be kept away from the authorities and protected.
Alistair, that gives us a perfect opportunity to bring in Andrew Luman. He's the Executive Director of the Tor Project. Thank you to you, Alistair. Andrew is the Executive Director of the Tor Project, which helped create the software that allows web users to be anonymous. And Andrew, good evening to you.
Good evening.
You believe that it is essentially a force for good?
Anonymity is a force for good. The technology we create is completely agnostic and can be used for good or for bad. We obviously try to promote the good uses. Sorry for the sirens. We try to promote the good uses, and work with law enforcement where needed to diminish the bad.
So where did Tor come from?
Tor originated from a U.S. Navy project called the Onion Router Project, where they were trying to find a way to defeat traffic analysis, which is sort of, if you think of the post office, they get to see all your envelopes and who you're sending to, who's receiving, and how often you send. And that was the core for the project.
And presumably then originally it had a military application if you used it, you know, for the US Navy. But surely you must have realised that an anonymous system like that, if distributed widely as it is now via the internet, could be exploited by criminals.
Yes, of course. Criminals already don't follow the laws, so they're willing to do anything necessary to practice their trade.
But that doesn't mean we have to make it easier for them, does it?
Right, but so I do work with victims of human trafficking and abuse, and the smartphone, in many cases, is their device of nightmares because it records exactly where you are at all points in time, can be used to listen to you, can be used to watch what you're doing on the internet, can be used for all sorts of surveillance. And if you're a stalking victim or an abuse victim, the phone is what you worry about far more than some esoteric software on the internet.
Is there anybody monitoring Tor?
We believe there are many people trying to monitor Tor.
But as the Tor project yourself, I mean, do you collect any information about the people who use your software?
No. So the first thing is we run an anonymity network, and we do not require any registration or demographics to be recorded. We will separate who you are from where you're going on the internet, and what you do with that is up to you. A number of people log into Facebook or to Google using Tor because their local government or national government censors the internet and does not allow them access to those websites. So for them, Tor is their way to get to Facebook to keep up what's going on with their families all around the world.
And do you believe that it's been used, for example, to protect activists in the Arab Spring, that people, for example, dissidents in China, have used it to avoid detection by what might be regarded as repressive regimes?
Yes. We have been involved with Tunisia, Egypt, and now Syria, as well as Bahrain, Oman, and other countries. China is another example where there are a number of people who want to promote their religious ideals in the country, and in doing so will get you either deported or jailed.
And how secure is it really? I mean, is it absolutely guaranteed that if you use Tor that your identity will never and can never be revealed?
We are fairly honest because we're a research and development organization, and we will tell you that we believe it is as secure and as anonymous as we can make you right now. However, we will also tell you, here are all the risks. If you are anonymous and you log into Facebook, then Facebook knows exactly who you are because you just logged in. They just don't know where you are on the internet. There's a lot of user education that needs to happen to explain that just because you're anonymous to the network itself, all the devices and the internet, doesn't mean the websites you log into and someone who's dedicated cannot eventually figure out who you are.
Go on, Mike, you had a question, I think.
I think you asked it for me, Adrian.
All right, brilliant. So, all right, well, Andrew Lumen and Mike Wendling for the moment, thank you. Now, this week, rescuers abandoned the search for any more bodies on board the Costa Concordia, which sank off the Italian coast. 17 people died and 15 are still missing. The captain, Francesco Schettino, who abandoned ship before all the passengers were evacuated, faces manslaughter charges. But Five Live Investigates can reveal tonight that the man who was due to take charge of safety on the Costa Concordia the next day also jumped ship early. This is a recording of the call between a very angry Coast Guard and the captain, who was on a lifeboat while the rescue was still underway. Now, you may have heard this before, but you might have missed this very clear reference to his second in command.
So what do you want to do, Schettino? You want to go back home? It's dark, so you want to get back home? Climb the bow of the ship using the ladder and tell me what has to be done. Tell me how many people there are and what they need. Now!
I am with the second in command.
Both of you go up then. You and your second in command, get on board now. Is that clear?
Still incredible to hear that, isn't it? But it was the mysterious second in command. Well, our reporter Simon Cox was intrigued by this reference and tried to find out who he was. Hi, Simon.
Hi there. Well, you can hear in this
clip from that conversation, which is in the original Italian. You might just be able to make out his name.
Come si chiama il secondo?
Dimitri.
Dimitri cosa?
Well, Simon, my Italian's not great, but I definitely heard Dimitri there.
Yeah, your Italian's probably as good as mine, to be honest. The captain says his second commander, Dimitrios Christidis, was with him. And the Coast Guard is telling him at this point there's already bodies being found on the boat and that both the captain and Mr. Christidis should get back on board the Concordia. And as far as we know, they didn't. We know Captain Scatino got on this lifeboat 6 hours before the last passenger was rescued from the boat. He's had lots of criticism, but Mr. Christidis hasn't featured in any of the coverage, and we were wondering exactly who he was, so we started doing some digging.
Yeah, so what exactly did you turn up?
Well, Costa Cruises told us that he was the staff captain, and he was on board Costa Concordia, as they said, for the handover process. Now, he was planned to take over as this staff captain on January the 14th, which, of course, was the day after the accident. Yeah. And his job would have been to deal with onboard discipline and, crucially, to take charge of safety, making sure the crew was ready for an emergency. Now, Costa said Mr. Christidis was effectively a passenger when the accident happened, but it's interesting that another senior officer, the man who was taking over safety matters on that boat in a matter of hours after the accident, also left the ship early.
Yeah, so what are the responsibilities of a captain then? Should he go down with the ship, as popular belief would have it?
Well, it's ultimately down to the regulations in your individual country. So we looked up the Italian Naval Code, and in the part about the obligations of the captain, it clearly states that the commander must abandon ship last.
OK, so that would apply to Captain Scatino, as he was in charge that night. But what about his second-in-command, Mr. Christidis, who was about to take over the next day?
It's a bit of a grey area there. The regulations laid down are for captains who are in charge of a vessel. They don't really cover people who aren't on duty. But when you talk to maritime experts about what to do in these sort of situations, they say morally, as a senior officer in this kind of emergency where you're going to be taking over the next day, you would be expected to take it upon your shoulders to make sure all the passengers got off before you did.
Thanks, Simon. Well, we can speak now to Janice Donoff, who, with her husband Ian, was one of the last passengers to leave the ship. Hi, Janice.
Hello. Hi, yeah. Adrian.
And the news that Dimitri Christidis was fairly off the ship, fairly sharpish, comes as no news to you and your husband.
Well, it's a bit of concern to us insofar as we were among the last 100 to get off the ship.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't quite know how they would have managed to get back on the ship logistically, but I do know that it would have been a great comfort to us if they had indeed climbed back onto the ship as the Coast Guard directed.
Yes, and I understand that your husband actually saw Dimitri Christidis getting off the ship and into a lifeboat well ahead of you.
No, we saw him at, we think we saw him at dinner with the captain.
Oh.
We were at dinner a couple of tables away from the captain and his lady friend, and a gentleman joined him who was definitely quite high up, who was shouting orders to the staff, and we think that was him. But no, because we believe we were on the other side of the ship from the captain.
What do you make of the fact, then, that there was another captain on board responsible for safety who left before you did?
Very distressing. Very distressing. I think that their job is to stay on board and to direct the evacuation and to assist those staff that have training. Not all the staff had training. There were staff when we actually boarded the lifeboat, which we eventually had to get out of, but there were staff on that life raft, as were we, and it obviously was not a case of all hands on board when there's a crisis.
And at one point you were trapped, I understand.
Yes, we boarded a lifeboat which could not drop because we were on the upper side of the ship and yeah, because of the angle. And we had to get off and get back onto the deck, so it was as if we were in a corridor which was tilting sharply. We were on the inner side of the deck, and it was incredibly scary. We thought we would die. We actually thought we were going to die at that point.
Fascinating stuff. Janice, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Clive Garner's also with us. He's a partner at Irwin Mitchell Solicitors, who has dealt with many maritime accidents and is representing dozens of crew and passengers of the Costa Concordia. Hi, Clive.
Hi.
So, have we established whether legally there is any responsibility for the senior officers and captains in an emergency like this?
Well, certainly as far as the captain is concerned, Simon's absolutely right. And it's a question of what the Italian regulations specify in terms of the captain's duty. And as far as the Italian regulations are concerned, they do require the captain to be the last man off the ship. And indeed, there's also sources of regulations. The Merchant Marine Officer's Handbook, for example, requires, again, the captain to be the last man off the ship. So it really is quite remarkable that in this case, Captain Scatino exited the ship quite so early, with literally hundreds of passengers and crew still on board.
Yeah, have you ever had to deal with any similar kind of cases?
We've dealt with many maritime disasters over many years, but I can't think of any where a captain has abdicated his duty along these lines and actually got off the ship before he's ensured that all of the crew and all of the passengers have safely left. I mean, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah, and what about the role of the second in command then, Dimitri Christidis?
Well, assuming that he wasn't on duty, and certainly that's what Costa is saying, and there's nothing that we know at the moment that would contradict that, then I think, although he has a moral duty, and again, I'm very surprised and disappointed that he hasn't actually taken steps himself to try and aid the passengers, but I don't think there's a legal duty on him if he's not actually on duty at the time. So very disappointing, very surprising, and certainly marine experts that I've spoken with have also been extremely disappointed, really, that he's decided to take that kind of action and put his own life before that of passengers and crew.
Yeah, now, Costa's owners are a company called Carnival. They control half of the cruise market globally. Are you looking at any other incidents involving this company?
Yes, and Carnival they're a huge provider of cruises, and virtually every week, actually, we are approached by passengers or crew who ask us to help with claims against Carnival or their subsidiary companies, including Costa, for injuries that they've suffered on board cruises. So they're a huge provider, but we come across many, many cases, and we act in many cases for victims who have suffered often very serious injuries, sometimes fatalities. And there are key themes that we sadly keep coming across time and time again, including training, supervision and oversight. And there are real issues. There's been some significant previous very serious incidents involving Costa Cruises and also Princess Cruises in the recent past, which really do flag up major concerns in terms of training and supervision. And really, this latest incident is just appalling on many, many levels, not just the evacuation, but obviously the circumstances leading up to the incident and the grounding of the ship itself. So there are an awful lot of questions that need to be answered, and we're looking at the pattern of incidences, not only in relation to this accident, but also previous accidents, including several where passengers and crew have lost their lives.
Fascinating stuff. Clive from Irwin Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us on Five Live Investigates tonight. Mike Wendling's been getting more of your texts, your emails and your tweets about the dark web, Mike.
Yeah, we've got plenty of them. One person texts in, the dark web isn't just used for illegal activities. Some of us just wish to protect our identity. Another text, more people using the dark web means more criminal profit.
Thanks for listening to the Five Live Investigates podcast. And don't forget, if there's something you want us to investigate, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.